Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
absolutely,
if we're uncomfortable talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
And good morning. Welcome to What's Next. Today, we're going to take a look at affordable housing, and we're also going to look at it through the lens of zoning here in Erie County and Western New York. Just before we get into this, I want to start off with a note from this particular report we're going to be talking about here. According to the United Nations, housing is, quote, more than just a roof. It's the opportunity for better lives and a better future. The UN calls housing a fundamental human right, which ensures access to a safe, secure, habitable, and affordable home. That we should all have access to housing as a dignified part of our lived experience is becoming more difficult to achieve as housing prices are rapidly passing low and moderate income workers by. Here to talk more about this, Jason Knight, Associate Professor at Buffalo State University. Dr. Knight, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So we had you in a couple of years ago to get in a conversation about a lot of different issues here in Western New York, but we found about your expertise in housing and your keen and specific interest in zoning issues that impact housing. You, at that time, were ready to embark on a sabbatical to work on developing opportunity, aligning zones with affordable housing needs. That's the report that you have put out. This is about mainly Erie County. So much inside this, but first and foremost, let's talk about just affordability overall, where Erie County stands when it comes to affordability for both single home or single unit housing and also for renters as well.
Sure. You know, historically, we've been a region where our housing prices, whether they're, you know, owner-occupied housing traditionally here, single family, and rents have been, you know, sort of celebrated as relatively affordable. And they still are, when you look at the national scale, the median sale price or median rents here don't look all that bad. But when you start to look at those things in relationship to how much money people have and incomes in our region, then it becomes a little bit more of a challenge. So we've seen a massive increase in housing prices, both on the rent side and the owner-occupied side. And that change is actually outpacing wage inflation significantly, in some cases, by about double. So we have an impending crisis facing us right now, and increasing the supply would be one way to help alleviate some of these challenges. But we also have an income problem.
And to that, just we want to get into a couple of terms here that might be worthwhile.
Sure.
Throughout our conversation. When it comes to households who pay more than 30% of their income on housing, there's a term that you utilize for that.
Yeah, so that's what we sort of kind of call the affordability threshold. So when you get every increment above 30%, you're paying for your housing costs, minimizes your ability to afford other things. When you get over 40 and 50%, you're sort of severely cost burdened. And that's typically a threshold we see renters passing by rather than single family homeowners. It's usually renters, predominantly renters in the city, but also some of our suburban rural communities where people are paying that rate, which is largely driven mostly by low and severely low incomes paying relatively high rents.
And we're going to get into zoning and how it impacts and basically restricts affordable housing, the development of affordable housing in a lot of the suburbs around Buffalo. But I just want to also, before it becomes this conversation that, oh, we're just talking about renters, there's also a I guess I'll take it from this that I understood that our zoning laws also are impacting the cost of single-family homes here in Erie County as well, significantly.
Significantly, yes. I mean, what we build and where we build it drive the price of that thing. And so what we build is largely single-family homes on very large lots relative to older urban neighborhoods and first-ring suburbs, so lots that are sometimes double, triple, and even more than that, the size of what we built in the past. And the average house we're building in the region right now is somewhere on the order of about 2,400 square feet, which is more than double what we were building in the 50s for households that had at least one more person. So we're building a lot of big stuff, and we're not building anything beneath that. So we're not building what we might call middle housing or workforce housing, and we're certainly not building enough either naturally affordable workforce rentals or low and mod rentals. So it's a trickle down.
Sure. And then just going back to the average size of these new homes, a lot of that is also mandated, right, by
the zoning code
requirements.
Drives that, really. When you require, say, a half-acre lot, no one's buying a half-acre lot in a community for $200,000 or $175,000 and putting a small ranch on it. It doesn't make economic sense. So the lot size really drives what gets built. And you know, if you think about what if you just had to pay $175 for just your mortgage.
Right.
That's still a considerable mortgage for most people. So someone that can afford that lot price certainly can afford the big house that's going to go on it. And so that's how we get these large houses out on the urban fringe. And, you know, we have to kind of fight over what's left behind, you know.
And there are communities, for the most part, where these homes are being built, correct?
Yeah, they're, you know, I kind of argue that it's the sort of transit road corridor, right, from the north to the south. So from effectively from Clarence down through Lancaster and Elma, Orchard Park, in a lesser extent, Hamburg sort of down the southern part. But the urban fringe, the growing communities that are seeing the vast majority of our housing construction are building it at a very large size and very high cost.
Now, at the moment, perhaps these communities are saying, great, we've got expensive homes that are they've got great market rates and they're going to be taxed appropriately and that's going to benefit our communities. But that doesn't last forever, does it?
No, it doesn't. And despite what people believe, residential home construction and development doesn't pay the bills. It generally costs more to deliver services to residential single family than that home will pay in taxes.
Really?
The way that gets subsidized or sort of balanced out is you have to offset that with commercial development that is not using the same services that residential does because they effectively get less services for every dollar they pay. So if you can somehow magically balance that, right, where you're subsidizing the overage that over-service delivery for residential by under-service delivery for commercial or non-residential, then you've got a balanced budget. But it just never, ever works out where more residential growth results in tax savings or reduction in services or anything like that. It actually costs you more money.
How could affordable housing fit into that equation in these communities? How could it? What would be the benefit?
Yeah.
Because, again, I'm sure I can only imagine some of the conversations you get into when you start talking about this because, you know, there is that American sense that my home, you know, this is my wealth opportunity. I want it to grow as I own it,
sure.
Right? Why would I want affordable housing in my community?
Yeah. Affordable housing is an interesting benefit, I think, from my perspective. And if we're building it at the right density, you're adding households to your community at a smaller density, right? So your units per acre are higher for, you know, multifamily affordable housing, even multifamily market rate, right? And by adding more of those households to your community, whether you can mix it up, right? You can have some affordable in a building with some market rate in a building, and you're adding households and you're adding money to your economy, which means you're adding and supporting local businesses and things that the community relies on. So it is a growth opportunity, but unfortunately we tend to look at it from the other lens, which is how is it going to detract from the value of my housing? And generally it just doesn't. It's just generally a myth. Because we don't do it enough. We get into this narrative where we think like, oh, if we build affordable housing, we're going to bring those people into our community and that's going to drive down property prices. It's not the people that necessarily live in the building. It's the quality and condition and maintenance of the building that has the greatest potential of driving down property prices, which means if it's an owner that doesn't invest in the building and maintain it and it starts to fall apart and it loses value, then that's going to have an impact on neighboring properties. That impact disappears, though, the farther you get away from that building. So there's a lot of myth involved in affordable housing development and the impacts it has on neighboring property prices, community property prices, neighborhood quality, community quality, the sense of place. All those things are bound up in this longstanding narrative that we just can't have that in our community because it has negative consequences. And that's really a sort of anti-social approach, I think.
And just to take that a little bit more historically, you know, and I use the term affordable housing. We can also use the term multifamily housing as well. And you, in your report, you cite a Supreme Court decision, I believe, from the 1920s. Was it Euclid, Ohio? And the term that were... I'm trying to find the term that was utilized. Mere parasites was how they described people in multifamily structures.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting, the history of the anti-multifamily housing type in this country runs right through Supreme Court decisions and Supreme Court justices saying things like that. Yeah, they were treated historically as lower class citizens. In Euclid, cemented zoning as a right of local government and an effective police power to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the community. And that sort of very indefinable health, safety, and welfare of the community is the way that we hold all these things in place. And so anything that is looks to be or is thought to be have a negative impact on the health, safety, and welfare of a community gives the community the right to zone, and then therefore it gives them the right to deny. And so they've always treated lower class housing, right? And that by lower class, you just mean lower income, right?
Right.
We always treated lower class income types of units as not amenable to what we want for our community because they might cost us more. This is where connecting it to that cost us more, right? And our job as politicians is to minimize the costs of local government service delivery, right? So it gets bound up in these really gray terms, and those gray terms are just used to deny.
So you've made the argument that multi-unit homes or structures, multifamily structures, will not be an impediment to property values in these communities, so that we've made that argument. Now let's take a look at some of the communities. Let's take a look at some of these, the zoning approaches. All right, well, I'm a developer, and I want to put a multi-family structure. I'll toss out of town. I'll just toss out Clarence. I want to put it there because it'd be a great place for my tenants. If they have children, they can go to this incredible school district. They can live in this community. What would a developer run into if they were doing it? And again, doesn't have to necessarily be Clarence, but let's just use that for now.
Sure. It's interesting that these communities treat multifamily as something that they're okay with, but then they socially engineer their code so that it only results in higher income households living in market rate affordable housing or market rate apartments effectively, right? So in a place like Clarence, they build apartments, right? But they're market rate and they're very expensive. And so they're very expensive because the zoning code dictates the number of units per acre that are permitted. Well, when you start doing the math, the development math on units per acre, the only way market rate housing on the rental side in Clarence actually works is high-end apartments. Because land costs are so high, the number of units per acre is so low, and the only way to balance that cost out, which is fewer units on a very expensive piece of land, is to rent them at market rates. So you're getting in the upper $2,000 a month, which is not affordable for anyone other than, you know, higher income households. So they do accept multifamily in some of these communities, but it's engineered so that they only get market rate higher income households.
It's a really interesting circle that we're going in here, and it's I want to continue with it for sure. One thing that I know about after reading your report, special use permits. So this is another zoning situation, another zoning regulation that is quite common around Western New York.
Very common.
How does that work? What does that mean, special use permit?
So as a landowner, you have rights through the zoning code in every community in New York State, right? And some of those are what are referred to as of right, which is your piece of land can be developed as the zoning code permits without any sort of approval process, which is largely, if in the report, single family is given that right and that privilege every single place in Western New
York.
They
might have to qualify for some building codes.
Yeah, just
like that.
A building permit.
Right, but not zoning.
They cannot deny you in an as-of-right zoning district your ability to build what the code permits. So if it's single family, all you need is a lot that meets the standard zoning regulations, and then it has to have sewer and water. So you need some public health things that's already sort of prior approved. And you just go pull a building permit with a set of architectural drawings for a new home and hire a contractor and off you go. Special use permit is a discretionary process or procedure where the local government has to provide you a yes or a no on a proposed project. And generally, single family is never anywhere in Western New York and Erie County never falls under a special use permit requirement because
right.
we privilege it. What does fall under special use is generally multifamily housing, so projects that are three units or more. So not your standard like double in Buffalo that we're all familiar with, first ring suburban doubles, right?
Right.
The upper lower, but the multifamily, the large scale apartments, right? So that process is you effectively have to go to the community and ask them for permission. And that brings in the ability for them to say no. And the grounds that they can say no are, we're here protecting the health, safety, and welfare of our community.
Even though there's all sorts of implications with that particular description. We're here with Jason Knight. We are talking about housing in Western New York, and specifically his report, Developing Opportunity, Aligning Zoning with Affordable Housing Needs. Right now, the way zoning is set up in Erie County, what do we end up with? We end up with, I guess, our neighborhoods are set up according to income. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, the zoning code is the filter, right? It filters people by income to geography, and it's really that simple, but it's a very complicated process, obviously. What we have in New York State is we are a home rule state, and so by that characterization, every municipality in Erie County has the untouchable right to set zoning in their community as they see fit. No one can tell them otherwise, right? So in Erie County, we have 44 what I call containers, right? Or from a housing perspective, submarkets.
Mm-hmm.
So you have 44 submarkets that each have their very own distinct zoning code that dictates what can be built where in their community. And that's the form and manner, the type, everything. And so everybody can kind of set their community up to be built and designed in the way that their residents and their elected officials want. And so that's where you get into this position where they go, well, we want to be just a single family only community. And so we're going to make single family only the dominant residential type in our community. Let affordable housing go to the community down the street that's willing to have it, right? Well, when everybody does the same thing, which is we don't want multifamily either, we're going to put all these restrictions on it. That's how you get this sort of undersupply of multifamily.
And right now, because of that, we've already talked about the rising prices, but there's also just overall a housing shortage in this area.
Yeah, the housing shortage questions is kind of a slippery slope. We've built enough units to equal the number of new households we've formed. So on a very simplistic sort of math level, we have a net sort of positive in terms of the number of units we've built relative to the number of households that have been formed. The problem is what we build is generally at the top,
right?
Right. So we're building at the top, which means as people move up the housing ladder, they vacate housing that gets bought up by someone who's maybe just beneath them on the economic ladder. And so we as sort of middle income households have to find a used house, really, like a car, right? You buy a used house in a community and you try to find a space. We're not building the middle. We're not building, relatively speaking, we're not building large numbers of small, modest houses. We build the biggest ones and let everybody find what's left.
Mm. And is that the way, I mean, again, you're focused on Erie County here. I know, I guess initially when you started off, Niagara County was kind of involved in a little bit of some analysis, but pretty much on Erie County. Is this generally reflected in other communities around the country?
Yeah, I mean, single-family suburban zoning is the dominant zoning classification in America. It's the way the suburbs were intended. I mean, that was the intent for the suburbs, which, and it was, the, what some research have called the sort of codified American dream, which is the suburban single family home on your own lot, detached from someone else's housing unit, right? The white picket fence, the 50s American dream. That's been packaged up for decades and sold to homeowners. And it's been pushed by bankers, builders, and developers as the only way to design our suburbs. So most American suburban communities are distinctly and undeniably dominated by single family zoning only, just like we are. So it's not a foreign process just in New York State. It's a pretty much a national undertaking.
So, but what it means for a community like ours, though, perhaps maybe a little bit different. The historic, when it comes to economics in Western New York, we can all go back and look at the slide that occurred. And, there might be some who consider that things steadied for a little bit, but whatever the case may be, this might not be a good mix for this region.
No, because what we have is, I kind of refer to it as a process of enclosure. You know, we're enclosing our lowest income households close to downtown Buffalo in the first ring suburbs. So when we look at where poverty exists and low and moderate income households exist, we're restricting the movement of those folks out of neighborhoods that they might not prefer and into neighborhoods that they might prefer because we don't provide them housing in those neighborhoods. And so the report gets into the sort of conversation about racialized economic segregation, right? So it's not a sexy topic, but the reality becomes if you're a low-income household in Western New York, your housing market opportunities are very limited. And your ability to acquire a house that you can afford. And listen, we have about a 50% renter affordability problem. About 50% of renters are spending more than 30% of their income on rent.
Mm.
So half of all renters are effectively trapped, right? That they can't find a affordable housing unit, first of all. And then when they do get a housing unit, even an unaffordable one, they're finding low-quality housing in urban neighborhoods, and then some of our first ring suburban communities are starting to capture some of those households. But it's a significant challenge that we lack the mobility that households might prefer and the opportunity for them to put their kids in a better school district, right? All the things that kind of come with that, have access to a neighborhood that might be a more healthy environment for them, right? So so by enclosing people in the city, in the first ring suburbs, we're effectively dividing the community on income lines.
And just from what you do, very very specific in this regard when we're talking about zoning, what's the what kind of interest do you get from local leaders, thinkers? What's the interest of, well, let's be honest, politicians, what elected officials, what kind of interest do they show in this reality?
Yeah, I don't think, my experience with some elected officials in the region and some members of planning boards and things like that is effectively, they speak in the same terms that people have always spoken in with regard to multifamily, which is, I would like it, but, who? Right? Who's it for? I've had conversations with people where I said, well, you're a community right now that your kids can't afford to live in because you require a large lot, single family only. And don't you want your kids to live here? And, they would almost be more willing to let their kids find something somewhere else than to allow.
You hear that?
Yeah. Then they allow the opportunity for their own children to maybe acquire an affordable housing unit, something smaller on a smaller lot, or build some multifamily apartments. Because when you minimize multifamily, you're also cutting it off from apartments for market rate people as well. So if you have a community that doesn't realize, you can do what Clarence does, which is design it so it can be market rate. When you effectively say, we're not doing any multifamily, well, you're keeping out potentially seniors, retirees, middle income households that want to be renters. So you cut off everybody to keep the poor people out, right? And that's a significant problem.
And one that is generally overlooked, or if not overlooked, just disdained for.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's hard to convince communities that they need to do this or consider to do this. It's the reason why we still have this problem,
right?
Right. It's hard to convince an elected official who feels like it's their role to be a gatekeeper and protect property values. That's the number one mentality, is protect property values. And so elected officials are not necessarily amenable to this kind of conversation.
So we're talking with Jason Knight, associate professor at Buffalo State University, about his report, Developing Opportunity, Aligning Zoning with Affordable Housing Needs. We're spending a little time, and I think it's a worthwhile time, to kind of go through this topic. It can be fairly complex, though. I got to give you credit, Dr. Knight. A Buff State grad like me was even able to make my way through it. So I guess you've been able to put it on that level, and that's most certainly worthwhile. But there are lots of interesting things, even here in Erie County. You get into this a little bit. I know you're involved in some housing summits, but you also you don't get into it a lot. But there is a little bit of discussion about some things on a county level. If I'm not mistaken, maybe in the 2000s, an effort was passed by the legislature to kind of develop a broader perspective on these housing issues. And if I'm not mistaken, it was vetoed by the county executive at the time.
Yeah, it wasn't specifically a housing focused effort. It was an attempt in the mid 2000s to get us up to speed, into the 21st century. And have a regional planning board,
right,
which we're the only upstate large metropolitan region that's functioning without a regional planning board, which effectively gives local governments more permission to act singularly within their containers, right? And so there's no one overseeing like, oh, this isn't best practice or this isn't good for the region. So we treat all the 44 municipalities as individual actors and we tell them to compete. And so we compete against each other, which is a problem. And so that effectively, that report was the Erie Niagara Regional Framework, or Framework for Regional Growth. And it was passed by the legislature to include the creation of a planning board. And then it was vetoed by the county executive at the time, which I believe was Chris Collins. And then they didn't have the votes, as I understand it, to override the veto with a supermajority. And it sort of died on the vine. And the idea is that we provide regional services across all these municipalities, but we don't have any. The county sort of provides roads and sewer districts, and we've got Erie County Water. So we have these large systems that are regional, but we allow the individual municipalities to plan locally without any regard for what that impact is regionally. And so it's a sort of a poor way to conceptualize how you plan for a singular economy.
We can't go back to 2006 and try to go through a trial on this. But at the same time, on the other side of the coin, these other upstate cities that do have regional planning boards, do you see, as best you can tell from your distance, that they're having success addressing some of these problems?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's more along the lines of infrastructure and growth that they can have the most impact. But I also think collectively, like, cities like Rochester and that region just have better outcomes in terms of how they plan and how they develop. And they have more capacity there. They have more affordable housing organizations. They're building housing. They just seem to have more engagement across the region than we have here. But we all, in the upstate sort of 90 corridor, we're all facing the exact same issues, right? Which is population stagnation or decline, and increased urbanization, which is growth or sprawl. And sort of that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So again, when you're a home rule community, you can have a regional planning board, but you don't necessarily have to follow any of their recommendations because they don't have any power. They're just sort of a advisory or recommending board. And the suburban communities can still just do whatever they want because zoning allows that.
But could you see, though, having a planning board at least maybe bringing these communities together, opening up conversations, maybe trying to find ways where some of these needs can be met?
To me, the value of a regional planning board is regional collaboration and not acting singularly to knife each other in the back as municipalities and fight for households and businesses. We can be better at this, and we just don't have that collective spirit. We pretend we're this sort of city of good neighbors, and it's largely a myth. We have
it's a nice slogan.
It's a nice slogan, but yeah, we have the same NIMBYism problems in the city that we have in the suburbs. I mean, so where's the city of good neighbors in that, right? Effectively, we're all trained to win, and the communities are in the same sort of mental situation. Particularly when you're facing decades of decline and disinvestment, and you have the power of local control over land use, and you see decline around you, and you see all this job loss for decades since 1950, you your government's goal then is to, like, well, how do we thwart this? Like, how do we compete and not become this community that's going to get fall into this avalanche of deindustrialization and decline? And so the system is set up for them to compete, and that's how they use their zoning codes in many ways to put themselves in competitive position for the highest income households and the best businesses.
And works for now while you're elected in office. It may not be
right.
You might not look so good in the history books maybe 20 or 40 years from now, I guess. Let's talk about land in Erie County. Lots of land in Erie County. How much of it is available for the uses that we're talking about here?
Yeah, when we look at available land, we have plenty. I mean, we don't have a land problem. So for some people, it's, well, how do we have such a supply problem? Well, you know, we have a supply problem not because we have too little available land. It's just we have too little capacity in a development community to build more and build at pace. But you got to remember, the builders are building based on their market analysis in terms of the number of new households that are formed and the number of and the income levels of households. So they're basically following the market. They're not going to overbuild, right? I mean, at the end of the day, why would you, if you're a developer who builds lots and you're a builder that builds houses, why would you flood the market with right. too many houses and decrease the value, right? So so we have plenty of land. We have plenty of land zoned for single family, and we have substantially less zoned for multifamily, and particularly less zoned for multifamily as of right, which is it's allowed to be built with a simple site plan approval that the town says, yep, you meet all the standards, have at it.
So there is almost, it's minuscule, the amount as of right.
Yeah, the as of right multifamily that is in appropriately zoned districts is somewhere on the order. I think I would estimate under 20 square miles total, where, you know, single families, you know, somewhere on the order of 180 or something like that square miles. So, you know, again, we privilege the single family and we minimize the multifamily, even though our renter rates are going up.
Right.
Right. So our renter rates are going up because housing is becoming more unaffordable.
Yeah. I think $1,300, a little over $1,300 is the average rent right now in Erie County. Do I have that right?
Yeah. I just pulled the numbers this morning, actually, and I can't remember what the current rent number is. Countywide 2023 median county rent is $1,067.
Okay.
That's the median.
That's the median, not the
average,
right? Yeah, okay.
Right. All and right. So, but in a place like Amherst, it's 1,400, 1,461, right? So it's varied across the county. And then the MSA, the two counties, is 1,054. So, you know, the county and then the two counties combined are relatively the same, but it's the higher end communities that have higher incomes generally have higher rents.
And also, I'm intrigued because this is a great example of what you're talking about here. There is, and it's been on the plans for a while to build a multi-unit affordable housing project or facility in the village of North Collins. I think it's the Rural Outreach Center.
Yep.
Their affordable or their housing development unit is trying to put that together. Let's go into the specifics of that because it sounds like a great idea. This is a village area, which will have access to sewer and water, right?
Yep.
What's keeping it from happening?
Money. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what keeps a lot of these affordable housing projects by nonprofits from happening quickly. It takes a long time to find the funding and stack it together from multiple sources to make it work. And then it's largely rural, so it has less potential dollars available to it. And it's a new organization on the housing side. So it doesn't, it's not really competitive for things like low-income housing tax credit programs that go to these big projects. So we kind of have to scrape together funding from multiple sources to try to make this project work. And we're limited in terms of total unit density on the site that we have.
Was it nine or 11?
I think we're between six and eight. There was a sort of break in some of our property area numbers that were a little confusing, and we were operating on the idea we would have eight. And on a lot that's maybe, I want to say somewhere on the order of like 12,000 square feet or something like that, which would allow us six. So we're kind of in this conversation about how do you proceed, but ultimately, you know, luckily, we got some money from Erie County through the American Rescue Plan for development. So we got some construction dollars that would include design and things like that. And we've got some capacity building dollars to help support the organization. But we're, you know, we're millions short in terms of total funding. Yeah, you know, somewhere probably on the order of maybe 1.8 to 2 million, something like that. You know, we don't have any assets, right? So we, Frank Cerny from Rural Outreach Center is amazing. Community-focused individual, and he deals with wraparound poverty services in Southern Erie through the Rural Outreach Center in East Aurora. And he said, he came to me one day after we made a presentation, he said, you know, everybody that I talk to that I deal with housing or with poverty services in my organization, the number one thing they say they struggle with is housing.
They tell housing.
Tell Frank, yeah, they tell Frank that.
And okay.
So the housing is a big challenge for low-income people because disproportionate amounts of their funding go to that thing. So when they go to Frank's organization for poverty services, wraparound for poverty services, Frank's realizing like how much money goes to really substandard housing in the Southern Erie County, high amounts of money for low quality housing. And so he said, look, why don't we just start an affordable housing corporation? So we started from nothing.
Okay.
With nothing. And then, you know, when you don't have funds and you don't have assets, it's hard to get money. So it's one of those real significant challenges where you start this organization and grant funders want to know you can do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right? So they want to know, can you do this, right? And so our first application to the Small Rural Development Grant Fund through New York State HCR, Housing Community Renewal, last year was denied. And we asked for effectively like $2 million, and it was denied. And then one of the key challenges was we just didn't exhibit the experience and the capacity to not just construct a project, because you have to stick around then and manage it. So you have to manage the building and you have to manage the tenants. And we didn't have a track record of that. So that was kind of the black eye. So it's really hard for a new organization to go, well, I want to step into this space and I want to build affordable housing units from scratch. It's a hard thing to endeavor.
Sure.
And then you got to find the money to do it. And that's the significant challenge.
Really interested in Mr. Cerny talking about the hearing from his people, the people that he works with. And I've been to his organization and I've seen it. And he does miraculous things and a very honorable effort for sure. But it strikes me to hear him say that there's a housing problem in Southern Erie County. And I just over the weekend, I took a ride into Allegheny County, beautiful county. Lots of old homes, and a significant number of them just run down, obvious, you know, almost hard to believe they can be habitable in any way.
Right.
Is that what we're seeing also in Southern Erie County?
Yeah, once you get south of, you know, Hamburger and Orchard Park, and you begin to get into the deep rural parts of Southern Erie County, and you get into the, certainly into the three southern counties of the region, Chautauqua, Cattaraugus, and Allegheny, you're getting into northern Appalachia. I mean, if you look at a map, the Appalachia Mountains come up through what we consider to be the southern tier.
Right.
And so it's not uncommon, and then, you know, crossing to Pennsylvania, it's not uncommon to see what you're describing. My grandparents lived in Angelica my whole life, and that's common down there. You know, they had friends that had a house with a dirt floor. Frank's told us stories about households with stacked stone exteriors where they're jamming like wads of paper in the walls to keep the drafts out. So rural poverty is a serious challenge. It's largely ignored. It's just unfortunate. It's largely ignored. It doesn't have the rates you see like in the city where you have some census tracts that are 30%, 40% poverty, but you're still like pockets of poverty down there, 15%, 10%, like, you know, it exists. And we ignore it because we don't have the funding streams and funding mechanisms to go down there and tackle it. And we certainly don't have the capacity to work in those spaces. You know, a county like Allegheny is, what, 50,000 people?
Right, right.
You know, so, you know, having an organization that can survive, right, because an organization has to survive on the rents, right, for these projects to make them pencil out and actually be sustainable. And it's a significant challenge when you get into those communities. So that's why you see, you know, trailers and manufactured homes are quite common down there because they're inexpensive. But they're a bigger maintenance challenge. And
they're not great investments.
They're not great investments. So, you know, they lose money. They don't gain money.
Right.
But that's a challenge that you face. So you go, well, I need to I can get a piece of land real cheap, and so I'll buy a manufactured home or buy a trailer, and, you know, hopefully that'll sustain us for a little bit of time here until we have to replace it, right? And so it's a the rural communities are a fascinating space that I haven't, frankly, spent enough time on, and a lot of us haven't, and particularly in this region, no one really does it. No one really focuses on rural. And so Frank really brought that to my attention and kind of pushed my focus and interest into that space a little bit.
And I'm just asking for a personal opinion of sorts here. You're a scholar, so you're looking at the data, you're analyzing, you're developing different corollaries and such. But when you talk about whether it's rural poverty or, you know, the inability to build multifamily affordable housing units in the communities around Erie County, I mean, is there, this is intractable. You might be able to move the needle slightly, but there's not a lot of hope, I guess.
It is a research area and a area of practice. I mean, I'm still doing this work. You know, I still try to support community-based efforts to improve the conditions in this community. That's my goal. So I'm not just a publishing scholar. Most of my work is professional applied stuff like this. There is a lot of hand-wringing and a lot of anguish over the inability to solve a lot of these problems. And so you spend a lot of time on it. And, you know, I have a lot of really close colleagues in this space that, you know, also have that feeling of we're kind of barely treading water. And, you know, a current political climate isn't making anyone feel any better about the situation, and more fearful of what the future might bring, because it doesn't seem like we're going to see a lot of improvement in the short term in this space.
We're going to take a time out. We'll come back with our final thoughts with Jason Knight. And I can tell you that in his report, there actually are optimistic elements. You know, it's interesting, inside your recommendations, I jumped to one about the Regional Planning Board a little earlier before. But one of the things I noticed, and this is one of those obscure things, but it's like, make sure online mapping and ordinances are current. Is that really a problem in communities here around Western New York?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes finding the information is kind of a challenge, you know, especially if you get out to the, rural communities that don't have a lot of staff, right, mm-hmm. that are just kind of running on bare bones, you know, a clerk, a treasurer, the volunteer village board or town board, right? They don't, a lot of that stuff just isn't publicly available, so you got to kind of dig for it, you know, and we did a lot of digging just to get to the point where we could map everything and find all the ordinances and review them. The ordinances are usually online, and those are usually pretty good. Most municipalities use an online service provider where their ordinance, their whole charter's there. So city, town, and village charters are online. Zoning's one of the chapters in the charter.
Sure.
Those are usually easy to find. But then when you find them, the maps a lot of times don't align with what the ordinance says. So it's not that the zoning districts are necessarily like the what's permitted is wrong, but the actual areas on the map might just be like the map might have been hand colored with markers in the 80s.
Okay.
And you know that's not the current zoning map.
Right.
Sometimes just looking at the ordinance, it'll say this was, revision date was 94 mm-hmm. and the map is still showing 1986. Right.
Gotcha.
So there's a lot of challenges. And often, sometimes if you're trying to do a project, you might just have to call the local government and say, I need to come in and sit with the building inspector and I need to figure this out, right? So, yeah, there's not a lot of, you know, in our rural or our urban and suburban communities, usually they're pretty close.
Okay.
They're usually pretty close.
All right. So let's maybe talk about some of the other recommendations that you had here. I mean, I suppose we're not going as much as I think Governor Hochul wanted to change this in the last budget or two budgets ago. We're not going to see a wide statewide change in the regulatory and zoning issues or zoning ordinances in these towns.
No. The moment she said it, I knew it was going to die.
Right.
These communities in New York State stand by their home rule authority as a right. It's a God-given right for them to decide what happens within their boundaries to as they see fit. And
sure.
any attempt to step over that is going to be met with fierce opposition, and certainly was, and rather quickly.
Right.
And so we're still going to always be bound by, I don't see any will to change the home rule to require a constitutional change in New York State anyway, but yeah. I just don't see any way that that ever happens.
Right. So what can happen? What can we do short term? What can we do long term?
Yeah, to me, it always comes down to carrots and sticks. You know, focusing on forcing municipalities to do things never usually works. What usually works is you create a system of incentives and disincentives, and that usually comes around money.
Right.
Right. So you find ways to provide communities benefit and support if they increase multifamily production or something to that effect. So, you know, it's money in terms of programs, but it might also be other types of support that can get communities to think a little bit differently about things, right? That's kind of where the governor's pro-housing classification came, where she asked communities to apply to be considered pro-housing communities, which would set you up for would give you more points on grant applications down the road. It's those types of things, which is, okay, we've given you pro-housing certification because you've met the criteria to be considered a pro-housing community, right? That now gives you extra points on certain grants that the state puts out, right? And by the pro-housing classification or certification, it just basically means you're providing new housing construction opportunities, increasing your portfolio of units or whatever the case may be, and you get this sort of benefit. And some communities still don't want to do it.
Right.
Right? And but I always call it the kind of coalition of the willing. Find the communities that are willing to do this kind of thing and help them and support them. And the ones that don't want to do it, as much as there's this desire to like make Clarence put in affordable housing, we're wasting our time on that argument, really, at the end of the day. We should be focused on where can we do this, who wants to do it, and how do we do it, and how do we fund it.
Okay.
That's the way we should be thinking about it.
All right.
And, you know, you got your first, like, places like Cheektowaga are okay. They want to do more development and redevelopment, right? I want to see reinvestment in their community. Most of our first-ring suburban communities that ring the city, multifamily is permitted as of right pretty much everywhere, right? So you can find those spaces for small infill projects in a city of Tonawanda where I live, or the town of Tonawanda, where multifamily is permitted. And generally, they're permitted at lot sizes and densities that make affordability possible, right? So you got to just identify where we can do it. And I think there's space to do it. There's just limited capacity and limited money, technical capacity and limited funds.
Sure, sure. And just to clarify, these inner ring towns are doing just fine.
Yeah. I mean, they're, you know, if we look at the inner ring suburbs, they're starting to experience, and many of them have been experiencing for decades, the process that was unfolding in Buffalo in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and that's population loss.
Mm-hmm.
You know, City of Tonawanda is roughly 75% of its total population from 1970 when it was a, you know, growing first ring suburb. You know, the town of Tonawanda, they are losing population. Cheektowaga is losing population. So, you know, historically, and they might, you know, they might be gaining population year over year and sort of spurts,
yep,
but generally speaking, the trajectory has been downward. And so those places are, you know, they're interested in redevelopment and you know, the idea of redevelopment and positive reinvestment in the community can spin off and get other people excited about reinvestment in your community. People are just looking to, I always say, looking to be the first to be second.
Right.
You know, show me that it's okay to invest in this place and I will. Well, you know, doing projects that have some component of affordability, maybe some market rate housing, tells people that maybe this is a place worthy of investment. And how do we do that? Housing is an economic development tool. Whether communities want to believe it or not, or even think about it, we treat economic development like this thing that we all must do.
Yes.
And it gets this massive privilege in our region. But economic development disconnected from how we house our workers is the absolute wrong way to think about economic development. We don't treat housing as the economic development tool that it is.
Simple enough in that regard. Again, back to the, you mentioned before, racialized economic segregation. It's a reality.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any trouble convincing people of that?
No, not when you show them the maps, right? When the map in this report, which is, you know, our lowest income black households are clustered on the east side of Buffalo, and there's no high wealth white households in that space. And if you go out to Clarence, our highest income households are clustered in Clarence, making the upper 20% of income largely white in Clarence. There's no impoverished black households making in the bottom 20%, right? So there's this spatial disconnect between where low-income black households live and high-income white households live. And that is effectively possible through zoning.
And I guess maybe just some, just to make sure, you made sure that I got my hands on this report. Is it available?
I believe it's online through the county, Erie County Department of Environmental Planning, I believe has a posted copy somewhere. You know, if not, people can track me down. I'm findable.
Yeah, Jason Knight is at Buffalo State University. And then I guess just to that, though, this has got to happen, right? I mean, if this community, this area is going to move forward into the future, 10, 20 years from now, we can't just be building just massive homes extending further out from the city center.
Yeah, and I think the long-term bigger challenge is as the region becomes more unaffordable for more people because housing prices are passing more of us by, the problem becomes even more acute, and we need to be more focused on it than we currently are because it's a serious, serious crisis, the affordability question.
Well, I enjoyed our conversation. Again, Jason Knight, Dr. Jason Knight, of associate professor at Buffalo State University. His report is called Developing Opportunity, Aligning Zoning with Affordable Housing Needs. This has been What's Next. Dr. Knight, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.